Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA. And by City Pulse, which today kicks off the final round of its Top of the Town contest. Information at LansingCityPulse.com.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. We're glad you're along. I'm Mark Bayshore. We have a great show today, I think, which combines really well the topical and the newsworthy, along with other really cool stuff going on. We've got Michigan State Spartans, a contingent of Spartans in China. We're going to get an update on later in the hour. Singer Janice Ian, who so many people remember from the 60s and the 70s and more recently, is on the show here today. Melissa Benmark speaks with her. Our Neighbors in Action segment, lots of good things, so we hope you can stick around. At the top, a federal judge has dealt a blow to a Michigan Indian tribe seeking to build a casino in downtown Lansing. I'm sure you've been following this. U.S. District Court Judge Robert Yonker has granted Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette's request for a preliminary injunction to stop the Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians from building that $245 million casino. The injunction puts the project on hold for now. Attorney John Wernette represents the Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians. He sees the decision as a temporary setback.
We're disappointed. This is a preliminary skirmish. It's not a final decision on the merits. I presume that the case is now going to go forward. We expect to be meeting with our litigation counsel in the next couple of days to discuss a course of action. But the essence of the court's decision is that the substance of the main case is not dismissed. It will go forward. We remain confident of our legal theories, and we intend to continue the fight, and we're confident that in the end we'll prevail.
And WKAR's Kevin Lavery has been following this one late yesterday and again this morning. How are you, Kevin?
I'm fine, Mark. Good morning.
Remind us first what the project involves and what exactly the judge ruled on yesterday.
Sure. Well, the Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians wants to build a 125,000-square-foot casino in downtown Lansing. It would be adjacent to and connect with the Lansing Center. A big deal on the radar of Lansing Mayor Virge Bernero, a project he's been touting for quite some time. It would create about 2,200 jobs, and it would also provide revenue for the Lansing Promise program, which is a scholarship program for city high school students. There were two motions pending before U.S. District Court Judge Yonker yesterday. One was Attorney General Bill Schuette's motion for the preliminary injunction that would prevent the tribe, as we said, from moving forward with an application to put this property upon which the casino would be built into trust, pending the resolution of a lawsuit he had against the tribe. The other motion was from the tribe asking the judge to dismiss the lawsuit on the grounds that the tribe has what's called sovereign immunity. The judge granted part of the tribe's motion. There was a lawsuit against some of the board members and the chairman of the tribe. That was dismissed. There were also a couple of other minor counts that were dismissed, but the judge did leave the meat of the lawsuit in place, the other four counts, the largest of which is the preliminary injunction, which for now puts the brakes on this whole thing.
So we wait for the results of the Attorney General's lawsuit attempting to stop this whole thing. What happens from here?
Right. Well, and the reason why he blocked the project is that back in 1993, that the tribe and the state entered a governing compact that allows gaming under certain conditions. Any tribe that wants to build a casino in Michigan has to first apply to the federal government to put this land into trust.
Okay.
Part of the compact says that because the tribe had failed to draft a written agreement with other tribes in the area for revenue sharing, that they were precluded from even applying to put the land in trust. There's a compact agreement that says you have to share revenue with the other tribes.
Okay. Yeah. And from here, we just wait until the results of the other lawsuit.
Right. From here, it could be the case could go to trial. It could be a summary judgment. As John Wernette said, they're meeting with their litigation team this week. So it's not precisely clear where it goes from here. But the chairman of the tribe, Aaron Payment, says they're not surprised. They expected about a two-year legal battle with this. So this is a bump in the road, but certainly not not the final word on this issue.
Top of the second inning, I think, as Mayor Bernero put it, in a nine-inning or extra-inning ball game. Who knows? Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you.
Michigan Attorney General. Current state on WKAR, Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette's taken action to dismiss a lawsuit seeking to overturn the state's controversial right-to-work law. In January, a coalition of groups, including the ACLU, the Michigan AFL-CIO, the Michigan Education Association, and others, filed the suit on the grounds that the December passage of right-to-work violated the state's Open Meetings Act. In the action taken Friday in Ingham County Circuit Court, the Attorney General denies the assertion and includes six sworn statements from the state police and legislative officers at the Capitol. Dan Korobkin is the legislative counsel for the Michigan ACLU, and he joins us to respond to the Attorney General's actions. Good morning, Dan.
Hey, Mark. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for joining us. Apparently, the AG is requesting dismissal of your suit on the grounds that there was no violation of the Open Meetings Act, since those meetings were open to the public, and I gather that his angle on this is that even after the Capitol building was closed, which it was, the gallery was still full of spectators. Is that a potential weakness in your case?
Well, I don't think so, Mark, but let me just start off by reminding everyone what this lawsuit is about. There was a lot of controversy over the substance of the right-to-work legislation because it was such a big change in public policy for our state. But the reason why we brought this lawsuit was not because of the substance of it, but because of the way it was passed. It was passed in an untransparent, undemocratic, unaccountable manner. It was rushed through the legislature in about a day. It did not go through the committee hearings that normally allow for public input on important legislation. It was done during a lame duck legislature, so after the elections had already occurred. And it's been they stuck in an appropriation into the bill to make it referendum proof from the voters ever overturning it. And so on top of all that, Mark, and why we brought this lawsuit, was that they closed the doors to the Capitol of the state of Michigan while this bill was being debated and voted upon. And from what we know and from what we can tell, this is an unprecedented event. You know, we've had many, 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 many controversial days in the Capitol in Lansing. But from what we can tell, this is the first time that the public has been locked out of the Capitol and not allowed to go in and share their views on the legislation. So we were expecting this kind of response from the state, which is essentially saying, look, there was a public safety concern. People who were in the Capitol were allowed to stay, but because of public safety concerns, we just couldn't let anyone else in.
So,
Yep.
But the basis of your lawsuit, is the violation of the Open Meetings Act, correct? But you're saying that since some number of people could not get in, that's a violation of the OMA, the Open Meetings Act. But even if the gallery is already full?
Well, the Open Meetings Act requires everyone to be allowed into to the session. Now, if you really can't get in, if you can't accommodate the number of people who want to get in, then all the government has to do is make reasonable accommodations for people. But that's not what happened here. Our understanding is that there were plenty of seats open in the galleries. It's our understanding that at least in one of the galleries, members of the legislative staff actually intentionally occupied the seats of the gallery to keep public citizens out. And so these allegations from the state, this defense from the state, it's expected, but you know, these are disputed facts and we're going to have to find out what really happened.
These are affidavits submitted by the sergeant at arms of the House and the Senate, and they state the gallery was at capacity, and they did allow new spectators in, but only when somebody left, which they said they did. You have doubts about those sworn statements then?
Well, yeah, you know, not all of those statements are, some of those are couched in pretty slippery language. It's not really clear who is seeing what and who is where to see what at what time. But yeah, that's correct. You know, we've spoken with plenty of people who saw that there were open seats in some of the galleries, and that and that the galleries were actually being occupied by some staffers who were trying to prevent members of the public from going in. And so these things are going to have to be worked out. But one thing to keep in mind here, Mark, is that the Capitol wasn't just closed for a short period of time to deal with some emergency situation. Capitol was closed all afternoon. And so not only is the question in this lawsuit whether if there's an emergency there can be temporary measures taken, but also whether it's really appropriate to close the Capitol for an entire afternoon while important bills are being debated. And so, you know, as the afternoon wore on, the halls of the Capitol began to empty out, the galleries emptied out. There were plenty of seats open, and members of the public who were standing outside who wanted to get in were locked out of the Capitol. They were told they couldn't come in. And so you know, these are the sort of things that really the state's affidavits and brief didn't really make clear, but that's what's going to be at issue in this case, and we're prepared to respond appropriately.
Well, are you willing to concede, Dan, that at some point safety may have been a perfectly legitimate issue, but you're just saying that it dragged on and they used it as an excuse not to let people in the Capitol?
You know, and I'm a civil rights and civil liberties attorney, and so I bring a lot of cases having to do with the First Amendment rights and the other constitutional rights of the public, and the general response, sort of, it's almost a knee-jerk response when these cases are brought up, is, well, there was a public safety issue. You know, well, there was, you know, we needed to deal with a public safety problem. Sometimes that's true. A lot of times it's not, Mark, and a lot of times public safety is being used as a catch-all phrase to try to justify whatever happens. You know, when there's something important going on and it involves the constitutional rights of the public to see what their government is doing and to be present when their government is taking important actions, you have to really scrutinize carefully whenever the government tries to block people from seeing what's happening under the guise of public safety. And so, you know, this is what the courts are for, right? I mean, this is why we have to solve disputes sometimes through the courts, is that sometimes one person's view of public safety doesn't really justify blocking the public from seeing what their government is doing.
What kind of timeline are you looking at here then, Dan? How do you expect things to unfold, and when do you expect things to unfold here coming up?
Well, as you mentioned, the state just filed a motion to dismiss the case, and the court has scheduled a hearing on that motion at the beginning of April. So, you know, in the next month or so, we're going to be putting together our response. The court will hear oral argument, and then after the court's decision, if the state is not successful in having the case dismissed, we're going to have a period of discovery and then perhaps even a trial. So, you know, this is we're in it for the long haul, and because this is an important issue about transparency in government, democratic decision making, and making sure that the public that the government is accountable to the people.
Dan Korobkin is the legislative counsel for the Michigan ACLU. Thank you, Dan.
You're welcome.
It's Current State on WKAR. Welcome back. For this week's Neighbors in Action segment, we feature the Teen After School Center at East Lansing's All Saints Episcopal Church just up the road. The program offers meals, mentorship, and other programs 2 days a week for about 50 students. And here with us now to tell us more is Father Andrew Shirota and parishioner Steve Finley. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Steve Finley, tell me, I'm led to believe this is... Could this be the first after-school program for youth in East Lansing? Can that be true?
Well, not really, but it's the first probably housed in a church. It started because All Saints was looking for a program they could call their own. They're already intimately involved with other local charities like Advent House or Haven House, but wanted to do something here. So they interviewed local community leaders like fire and police and education. And from those interviews came the need for teens in the after school part of their day. And so that's how it started. It started, East Lansing used to do it at the Hanna Community Center, but budget cuts stopped that. And then they were doing it in the library, and it overwhelmed the library. So the library was glad to hear someone else wanted to help.
Father Andrew, tell us then about the young people and the families that you serve then. How is it they have no place to go after school?
Well, many students that come to our Teen After School Center come from the west side of the Lansing neighborhood. So we presume that many of them are school of choice kids.
Okay.
So after school, without going to a specific place or without being part of the sports program, they need a place to just hang out waiting for their parents.
So, and I understand you've got some very interesting stories to share with us here. You had one super senior. You served some super seniors. What are super seniors? What are they?
Super seniors are either the teenagers that are already graduated from high school, or for some reason that they are no longer attending, and they clearly didn't have any place to go. And then one of the things that our program decided to do was to invite them to become part of our volunteers, which meant that they have to go through the same screening and then training just like the rest of us, so that they would be mentored by the adult volunteers and then learning to be more responsible and so forth.
And I understand you had one super senior who experienced a death in the family and had some struggles dealing with that, and you were able to offer some assistance there?
Yes. Basically, he had never attended any funerals before, and then did not know how to participate in a funeral. So basically, he came and then asked me how to go about it, and then how to dress and how to carry himself and so forth.
That can be stressful. The first funeral. I didn't attend mine until I was a teenager, and I was probably more stressed out than I ever would have been if had I been younger. I think it's almost more constructive and less nerve-wracking if you do it as a younger kid than you do as a teenager. But it's interesting the service that you end up offering through this whole thing. And Steve Finley, how did you get involved exactly?
Well, I was between jobs, so I was volunteering at TASC, and I took care of all the meals that they did for a year. And so I really enjoyed meeting the students. Some of them wanted to learn how to cook, so we did some of that. It's really quite a wonderful program.
Was it tough getting the students to trust you at first? I mean, was there a period? I'm getting some laughter. I trust that it was.
Very much so. I think Andrew could probably talk more about that. Yeah.
Why?
Well, you know, the fact that we're offering it at the church, we only had about 20 students at first, and they were very skeptical. In fact, the library staff had to walk with the kids to come to our facility, and then making sure that everything is fine and then safe. And then we are not here to, you know, let them know that we are not here to evangelize or...
Was that that was the main thing? They were concerned that you were going to evangelize.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
How has the program changed since, well, first of all, how long has the program been around?
About a year and a half. Okay. Started in September 2011.
And it's really taken off from what I understand. Mm-hmm. How has it changed in a year and a half?
I think that we definitely have gained some trust among the youth and the youth and the volunteers. And our mission is to provide a safe and a hate-free and youth-driven zone in the heart of East Lansing. And I think that the youth definitely trust that and understand the purpose of a program. And more conversations, and they, not only that, but the kids are now involved trying to cook or trying to offer some programs or send us requests. Their sense of ownership in this program is definitely increasing, and that's the change that I observe.
You rely on volunteers. What particular skills do your volunteers really need to have?
I think they have to have a good listening ear and and a willingness at least to engage with youth. I mean, sometimes they'll say things or maybe they shouldn't, but you just have to listen to them. And I think that most volunteers have been felt that they got the better end of the deal just by being there.
What's the school system had to say, if anything, about your program?
Yes, we now have a community advisory councils, and many school leaders and the police officers, they participate in a meet every quarter. They really appreciate it. Police Officer Steve Voiling said that he appreciates how much that we do to keep those kids from the getting into troubles. And
So these are a lot of kids with single parent homes or homes where the parents are still at work when the kids get out of school. Is that the heart of this, or is it there more to it than that?
We haven't really studied about their home and family structures, but the many of them do wait for their parents come in to give them a ride. So
I think mostly it's that they're not in clubs or sports,
right.
And so they might have a single parent or two that work, so that they aren't just going home after school. They don't have that place. And I think the Teen After School Center offers a variety. You know, there's games, there's computers, there are people to talk to and help mentor, do homework with them. They do music. Some of them bring guitars, can play. They can cook. There's a variety of things they can do in, as Andrew says, a safe environment.
What about the summertime? What happens then?
Currently, we're not doing anything during the summer, basically because we don't have any kids around. They're somewhere else.
They're managing to occupy themselves somehow.
Yeah. But we have had a conversation about doing something for the kids during the summer as well.
Okay. The enrollment or participation, I guess, has really taken off. You started out with about 20 students. You were very skeptical at first. And
yeah.
You serve how many now?
Average students are about 45 to 50, but we have about 110 registered students.
Okay.
And age-wise, racially, they're all diverse. Very diverse.
How do you pay for it? How much budget do you have to come up with here to keep this thing going?
Pretty much. Do you want to say something?
No, I just want to say it's been a challenge. I would say All Saints parishioners paid for most of the first year, and they're looking for ways to help increase this program, either in the community or through grants. So they are actively pursuing grants.
What could you use most of right now? I mean, is it could you use more human resources? Could you use more financial resources?
All.
All of the above. I could hear that one coming.
Yes.
How much more money would you like? How much more money would you need to make this?
Well, we're trying to raise...
Are you to the point where you've got an accountant yet who
yes.
can actually sort these things
we
out?
We definitely need $15,000 more that I know that.
Okay.
$15,000
would accomplish what? Would better accommodate the number of students you serve now? Or,
now
or,
in
or
the
that's
future,
the number you project in the future as well?
Project to cover a year of 2014, I think.
Okay. How well do older people, if older people responded by wanting to become a volunteer,
mm-hmm.
how generally does that play out? Do you feel like these people just relate better to younger counseling?
I agree. And we were concerned to have the volunteers that are too elderly, too old. However, what we observed is that they're the ones that are not afraid of speaking up and then set the boundary if necessary. And they're the ones who are so experienced to listen to kids' story and ask them how their days are like. And they're relaxed and reliable, and we need them. And the kids also gave the senior citizens also hope that they also have something to offer as well.
That's nice. Father Andrew Shirota and Steve Finley are with East Lansing's All Saints Episcopal Church. Thank you for telling us about your Teen After School Center.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
If you'd like to nominate someone or an organization to be featured on our Neighbors in Action segment, just send us an email to currentstate@wkar.org, put Neighbors in Action in the subject line, and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. You can even nominate yourself if you like. The Teen After School Center at All Saints Episcopal Church was nominated by listener Sarah Midzelkowski. Current State on WKAR. Coming up in the second half of the program, we will be visiting with singer Janice Ian, who is coming to the 10 Pound Fiddle Coffee House in East Lansing. We also have a bunch of Spartans in China, in Beijing specifically, and we'll be updating that situation here in the second half of the program. Back on Tuesday, Democratic Senate leaders reintroduced their Michigan 2020 plan that proposes to guarantee college tuition for all Michigan high school graduates. Senator Rebecca Warren from Ann Arbor is one of the proposal's lead backer, and she joins us now to update the whole effort. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning, Mark. Thanks so much for the invitation to be with you this morning.
That's quite all right. It's our pleasure. Your party yesterday identified the 2020 proposal as its highest legislative priority. Why is that number one?
Well, let me tell you a little story about the district I represent. I represent the bulk of Washtenaw County. I have two of the 15 public colleges and universities in the district that I represent, the University of Michigan and Eastern Michigan University. And I have two striking statistics. I have the largest concentration of Michigan citizens with a bachelor's degree and above, and I have consistently one of the lowest unemployment rates in the state. So those two things don't happen in a vacuum. We know that the best indicators of people's future employment success in terms of the money they will make over a lifetime and the ability to have a job that is not as subject to the whims of sort of cyclical economic pressures is making sure that they have that higher education. So for us, we really believe one of the best things we can do to invest in our future is make sure that our young people who are today working hard, motivated, doing the right things, don't let finances be the barrier that keeps them from getting that higher education they need to be successful.
Well, the plan would come up with a couple billion dollars for universal college education for all Michigan high school graduates by eliminating dubious tax loopholes. Last year when I spoke with Senator Gretchen Whitmer, the author of the measure, here's how she put it.
What we do is we create a nonpartisan group of economists to go through all the special interest loopholes that are codified right now and say, this isn't working. This isn't creating jobs, and it doesn't serve a public purpose. It's just a special interest kickback. Let's get rid of it.
So that was Senator Whitmer last year. Is that still how the proposal would work?
Well, I have to be honest, Mark, the technology, the way it worked, I didn't get to hear what Senator Whitmer said. I just got to hear kind of silence.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Put her on, but,
I'm sorry.
I'll tell you.
I'll be happy to just paraphrase what she said. She said we'll create a nonpartisan group of economists to go through all the special interest loopholes that are codified right now, and they'll say, this isn't working, this isn't creating jobs, and it doesn't serve a public purpose, it's just a special interest kickback, let's get rid of it. Is that still how this would work?
That is still the heart of the plan, and for us, you know, the Constitution is very clear that the state can spend no resources unless the legislature appropriates them, and for every other sector of our, you know, the $51 billion enterprise that is state government, we look at every year a budget for every department, for every agency, and we make those appropriations. The only place that's not true are on these tax expenditures, some of which have been on the books for 10 years, for 20 years or more. And this idea to say, first of all, kind of working together, the pieces of the puzzle are that we sunset those tax expenditures. Because sometimes there is a reason at the time when a certain industry is struggling or we're trying to develop a certain industry, we help them with a tax credit, a tax giveaway like that. But if we don't look at it again, you know, a business or an industry we wanted to help 20 years ago might not need the same help today, but they're still getting the tax credit. So, and having a nonpartisan economist look at them and say, you know, a letter grade A to F, is it working? Is it serving a public purpose? Then that gives the legislature, especially in this term limited environment where some folks might not even, you know, have the ability to recall how these things came to be, gives them a tool to look at whether or not that's something we want to continue. Because to be honest, some of them I think we will want to continue. They're serving a good purpose. They are doing what we want them to do. We just need to be smart about which ones we want to continue.
I'm really intrigued at how you come up with this nonpartisan group of economists. How will that take shape?
Well, I think, you know, we have a lot of wonderful research universities in this state. We have a lot of really talented economists, from academia that are not seen as, you know, as the folks that are sort of hired either by the far right or the far left, but folks who are doing academic research in our research universities, which I think for me is a place where most people can agree the goals are not, you know, as politically pre-spun. You know, they're the folks who are hoping to just get to the right answer. So I think for a lot of us, we're thinking that in the ivory towers of some of the research universities we have, we've got some great economists that we could tap to do this work.
How many do you want to line up? Do you know?
The way that it was put together, I think it's 7.
Okay. And who will select those economists?
That piece of legislation is not mine, so I don't know the details of that one quite as well as I do. My bill is the actually creates the grant program, so unfortunately I don't have quite as many details about that piece of the puzzle, how that comes together.
What do you expect to be harder, Rebecca, agreeing on that nonpartisan group of economists or consensus on actually cutting $2 billion worth of loopholes?
Well, a great thing about this package, the way it works together, because the one bill in the package does sunset these expenditures at the four-year mark. So at some point, a legislature wouldn't have to take action to keep them from going away. They would have to take action to keep them. So sometimes it's, the status quo is easy to maintain when there's no push against it. But if those things were to just begin to sunset and fall off, And this current legislature or future legislators had to actually evaluate the program, see if it's working, decide to vote to keep it, that just makes the whole thing a very different conversation than, you know, something that's just been kind of on the shelf and quietly doing its work for whatever period of time, whether it's really effective work or not, it's been there doing it.
According to this morning's Lansing State Journal, there isn't a single Republican signed on for this yet. If you add to that the fact that, well, are these tax breaks geared largely to the business sector then?
No, in the governor's budget that he proposed in February this year, the part of the budget package is the summary of the tax expenditures that we have. There are about $35 billion in tax expenditures in the 2013-2014 fiscal year that we're looking at beginning right now, the budget process for the budget that begins in October this year. And some of them are things like, you know, the voter-initiated no sales tax on food and prescription drugs. So things like that that are very much on individuals. And also part of that group, I was saying, of things that we probably wouldn't want to touch that we think have a good public purpose. So some of them are personal. They're the personal exemptions and the food and drug sales tax exemption. But often some of them are on businesses and different segments of the corporate community.
This would be, I mean, this would be a significant breakthrough in bipartisanship if successful. Wouldn't you agree?
I think so. And I think, you know, for us, we have a lot of conversations these days about being, you know, about being very effective and efficient with the state's dollars and making investments that are really going to pay dividends in the future. And this one for us, we feel like is just such an obvious, the return on investment is so huge. And it's for our students that would have the support to go to college that will keep them here in the state and stop the brain drain of our young people leaving the state, that just the economic activity that we know is generated around our you know, public colleges and universities in the state. The University Research Corridor, which is the name for the University of Michigan, Michigan State University, and Wayne State University, and the work that they kind of generate all together, in 2011 alone generated $15.5 billion in economic activity, 74,000 jobs. So we know that investing in our students, investing in our universities, has an outcome for not just, you know, a positive benefit to that person who's going to have that degree and be able to get a better job and a more secure job and a better paying job, but for all of us, it has such an impact on the future of the state and the jobs that we can attract. We hear from folks looking to locate businesses in new states and looking at a state like Michigan, the single biggest factor they look at for business attraction is concentration of talent. And the more we can do to send the signal to in this global economy we're in, to companies all over this country and all over the world, that Michigan has the talent, we're going to keep developing the talent, I think that is a big bipartisan message. It is something we should send together and hopefully you know, really change Michigan's future going forward.
And you'd realistically like to see passage this year?
Absolutely. I mean, the reason that we call this the 2020 plan is that we started looking at the things that are happening in Michigan's economy. And there's a recent study that says by 2020, the number of Michiganders that have a bachelor's degree needs to increase by nearly 1 million, by 100,000 and some change, to just maintain the jobs that we have now. Because so many of the jobs that we have, even, say, in manufacturing sector or something where you might not have always needed an advanced degree, now have become advanced manufacturing, where you do need more skills, more training, a degree, a certificate program from a community college, something.
All right. I'm afraid we're out of time, Rebecca, but we really do appreciate your time. Senator Rebecca Warren from Ann Arbor, one of the supporters of the Michigan 2020 plan. Thanks again. On Friday, musician Janice Ian will perform at the 10-Pound Fiddle in East Lansing. In 1967, Ian wrote her first hit song. It was called Society's Child, and it was about an interracial relationship. She was 13 years old.
Come to my door, baby. Face is clean and shining black as night. My mother went to answer, you know that she looked so fine.
The song was banned by some radio stations, and Ian received hate mail, but it became a national hit after conductor Leonard Bernstein featured it in a TV special. In 1975, Janice Ian won a Grammy Award for her song At 17. Fast forward through dozens of albums and projects to 2013, and Ian wins her second Grammy, this time for a spoken word recording of her autobiography called Society's Child. WKAR's Melissa Benmark caught up with Janice Ian by phone and asked her how this latest Grammy felt.
It's astonishing, especially to win two Grammys 30 years apart. I mean, who would have thought? And especially in that company, I don't think there's many people who can say that they went up against Bill Clinton, Rachel Maddow, the First Lady, and Ellen DeGeneres, and actually came out winning. It was cool because Michelle Obama tweeted me her congratulations, which was amazing. And Rachel Maddow sent me the most beautiful flowers, which was likewise amazing. So, and it's great to have the recognition of your peers. You know, that's the stock answer. But for me, I think it means even more because I started when I was only 12 or 13. So I grew up in the industry, much like Sally Field did in hers. And I think it's the same kind of thing. You grow up under that lens, and then you're finally a grown-up, and everybody goes, oh, and we still like you. So it's an amazing thing.
You know, the fact that the Spoken Word Award was for your own autobiography, it wasn't for you reading something of somebody else's.
Well, that would have been fine, too. I mean, that's actually one of the things that I'm doing now is reading other people's books. But, yeah, I think that because it was my autobiography, because it's, as far as we can tell, it was the first book to really try to interweave music and words pretty seamlessly. I sat in the studio with the guitar, and I spoke and then sang and spoke and then sang. I think it's much more a storytelling than most of the spoken word books are.
In reading up for this interview, I was just astonished at my impression of your life in music is that you just came out of the gate kicking. You were doing things, you know, you were writing early to start with, as you said, from the age of 12, and recording early, and recording things that no one else in that era was recording.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that was just sheer luck, or dumb luck, depending on how you look at it. I grew up in a very political family. My mom was in the Civil Rights Congress, a participant. My father was certainly active in those areas. I come from a union family, in the old sense of the union, and I grew up stuffing envelopes with memos for peace marches and stuff like that. So it was pretty natural that I'd be writing about things that had social import. That was what everybody around me was doing and talking about.
I was looking at other people who charted that year, and one thing I was, in 1975, I'm moving ahead now a little bit to at 17, you know, the other people were Helen Reddy and the Carpenters, you know, Karen Carpenter, Tony Tennille, I think, was number one. Not to criticize their work in any way, but this is a whole lot different than a song of the autobiographical truth-telling of At 17.
Well, I don't know that it's women as so much as just across the board. I mean, nobody was really doing that. You had Society's Child, and you had Barry McGuire's Eve of Destruction at that point, and that was kind of it for what was being played on AM radio. I think the more salient point to me is something that Donny Osmond pointed out to me once. He said that there were only five of us making music at that age. It was Brenda Lee, me, Donny, Stevie Wonder, and Michael Jackson. And he said, and of the five, only you and Stevie Wonder were writing, and only you were writing political songs. So to me, I always saw that as the interesting part, I guess. The women's thing, I was very fortunate in my first producer, Shadow Morton, and my band in the studio, Artie Butler and Vinnie Bell and people like that, because they didn't care. And that's been my experience over and over again, is that really good artists, really great artists, don't care about gender, they don't care about age, they don't care about color or nationality, they just care about the work. I think when it comes to public perception, most of the women were following the traditional paths. Most of those women were also married. Most of those women were either writing with, or in the case of Carole King, or being managed by, in the case of Helen Reddy, their husbands. I was 14, so there was no question of my being married to somebody. So I kind of escaped that whole thing, too.
Another thing that's been mentioned in some of the writing about you is that you escaped some of the bad things that happened to really thoughtful artists in the 60s and 70s. What do you attribute that to?
Well, I was too young. I mean, fortunately for me, I was too young, and I was constantly being shoved out of the room by people like Joplin and Hendrix, and told that I wasn't allowed to stay there while they were doing drugs.
Really? So they looked out for you?
Yeah, I think, in a sense, everybody looked out for me. I was very fortunate.
You've recorded so many albums and been involved in so many projects. You've written science fiction. You've had a performing career for the better part of 50 years. But to a casual observer, they know you from your radio hits, and particularly at 17. And I wonder, does that become an albatross in a way, or is it something that you're glad you've done?
Well, I guess it would depend on the song. I mean, I'm fortunate that at 17 and Society's Child and Jesse are not songs to be embarrassed by.
Right.
So I feel very fortunate that I have those in my catalog. You know, I still get to earn a living. I mean, I started when I was 14, so what's that? 46 years ago.
Right.
That's unbelievable that I can still earn a living doing this.
Right. No, I'm just remembering there's a Joe Walsh story that I think it was about Rocky Mountain Way. He said, if I would have realized I would have had to play this song the rest of my life, I would have written a different song.
Well, that's too bad.
It is.
You know?
It really is.
And that's also kind of a slap in the face. No offense to him, but that's a slap in the face to everybody who loves that song.
Right. Right.
I don't understand. I'm very grateful for every good song I've written.
What are you excited about working on now? What will you be bringing to East Lansing when you're here next week?
I'll be doing old songs and new songs. I'm starting to break in new songs for a next album, hopefully next year. I've got a children's illustrated book called The Tiny Mouse that's coming out in September about a tiny mouse that runs away to sea. And so I'll be breaking in that song as well because it's going on a CD with the book. I'm going to try and stay home a lot this year, although the Grammy win has kind of torched that.
Whoops.
Here and there. It's great to be wanted, but it's certainly time-consuming. But my plan is to stay home as much as possible and write.
That was WKAR's Melissa Benmark speaking with Janice Ian, who is coming to East Lansing's 10-Pound Fiddle Coffee House in the next couple of days. It's Current State here on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's no secret that the Chinese student population has exploded at Michigan State over the last 5 years, and with that, there has been some friction, including last fall, when some Chinese students' cars were vandalized with graffiti telling them to go back home. In an effort to improve cultural understanding among MSU staff and students, a delegation of students, faculty, and staff is visiting China's capital city of Beijing this week to meet with their counterparts at Beijing Normal University. The MSU Alumni Association Scott Westerman reports that the challenges of being a college student in China and in East Lansing are not all that different.
Beijing Normal University is a virtual postage stamp amidst the sprawl of China's capital city. It serves 21,000 students in an area about the size of MSU's Brody Complex. Like Michigan State University, Beijing Normal is one of the nation's top producers of classroom teachers. It also houses the bulk of its student population on campus. So when a team from MSU Student Life and Residence and Hospitality Services was looking for a place to learn how we could better serve the 3,000-plus Chinese students that come to East Lansing each year, a visit to Beijing Normal made perfect sense.
The number of students we have coming to Michigan State University and coming to East Lansing necessitates our better understanding the culture from which they come. And this is a great opportunity for student staff in our halls and student leaders on our campus to get that sense and really make a difference for the students who come to East Lansing.
That's Dr. Denise Maybank, MSU's interim vice president for student affairs, leader of a team of 16 faculty, staff, and students who journeyed to China this week to meet their counterparts and learn about the student experience. Dr. Kathy Collins, director of campus living and residence life, immediately saw a number of similarities amidst this vast cultural gulf.
Whether it's going to a game or enjoying other activities on campus, we're focused on their success and helping them succeed in their march toward that commencement ceremony. And as we focus on that every day, I could hear that today in the voices of our colleagues at Beijing Normal University. I think the other thing that I heard in our voices of our colleagues was that a 19-year-old's a 19-year-old, a 20-year-old's a 20-year-old, and how do we work on that and bringing all of those people together? Because I could see instant connections today between our students and their students and the excitement our students had in meeting people their own ages and sharing those experiences.
Jaleesa Brooks, Political Theory, Constitutional Democracy, sophomore. It was impressive to see how they have most of their campus, most of their population on campus, their dedication to academic success, as well as innovative the learning and living experience, how they have campus security, the same amounts of clubs, and they're striving towards engagement, and the fact that they're interested in the RA position. So that was pretty cool how similar we are.
Alateab knows about the challenge of acclimating firsthand. When he arrived as a freshman from Saudi Arabia, he had yet to develop a command of the English language. His determination to succeed as a Spartan led to his selection as a member of the 2012-2013 homecoming court. As we donned electronic earpieces to translate our Chinese tour guide's commentary into English, he suggested that multilingual signage and a basic knowledge of multiple languages could help resident assistants better connect with foreign students.
To be more culturally sensitive, so as an instance, to know, like, I think that should be for the RAs and the aides, is to at least understand, like, the greeting languages for, like, the international students. So if a Chinese student comes to you and he's new, you could say ni hao, and that would make that student feel like they're at home, you know. If an Arab student comes to you, you say salam, which is hi. So this is something maybe we should, like, incorporate in the training, like a cheat sheet for greetings in each language. That's one of the things that I noticed so far.
This is intimate, isn't it?
It is. Very nice and tight.
We toured a typical residence hall where 3,000 graduate students live, four to a bedroom, in roughly the same square footage MSU uses to house two undergraduate students. But it isn't the tight quarters that cause stress for these young people. Hu Shifang, who directs the Center for Psychological Counseling at Peking Normal University, says that one offshoot of China's one-child policy can be a situation where too much love at home sometimes makes the tough love of academia harder to endure.
You know, the parents always say, I love you, and yes, yes. First no. But if they go into the university, there is a lot of no to them.
This one looks like you?
Yes. It's not the ideal place.
As the needs of the student population continue to evolve, one goal never changes. Both Dr. Maybank and Dr. Collins highlighted student success in life as the ultimate desired outcome, an objective echoed by their Chinese counterpart, Dr. Wang Luzang, director of Peking Normal's Research Center for University Student Development.
I very much agree with that the success of our students. Hope they would graduate smoothly and successfully and find a good job and build up good families later on, and they become academic successful or career-wise professionally successful. So these are the goals for student affairs work.
The MSU delegation will continue their immersion in Chinese academic life through the weekend, a unique spring break for the student participants, and an opportunity for faculty and staff on both sides of the Pacific to work together to improve student life for everyone involved. Reporting from Beijing for Current State, I'm Scott Westerman.
Thanks very much for joining us for today's program. Tomorrow on Current State, lots of things, but among them, we'll run through the rest of the Wharton Center's season. That and more tomorrow on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer of Current State. Also, thanks to Aaron Young for engineering. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by Astera Credit Union, a proud supporter of Current State's Neighbors in Action segment. Newest location is now open on West Saginaw Highway on Lansing's west side. Information at asteracu.com. And by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu.